work, wealth, wisdom. This is DC Entrepreneur. We're sharing stories, ideas, and lessons from businesses in the pursuit of innovation. And we're helping build a community of problem solvers and thought leaders in the Washington area. Now, here's your host, George Macharko.
This is George Macharko, host of DC Entrepreneur, here on WERA 96.7 FM. We're bringing you more great conversations with leading innovators and entrepreneurs in the Washington, D.C. area. Let's introduce the guests. So right here, we've got Monica Kang. She is the founder of Innovators Box and the author of Rethink Creativity. Andrew Dana, he is the founder and co-owner of Call Your Mother Deli and Timber Pizza. And Chad is the founder of RemodelMate. So we've got three great entrepreneurship guests here. So, the theme of this episode is how I left my job to start my own business.
Sure. Thanks for having me. My name's Monica Kang from Innovators Box. Our company is a creative leadership firm on the mission to unlock creativity for all. 87% of the workforce today feels stuck, and I was one of them as well, and so we're on the mission to help transform what that means.
Very cool. My pitch is much less official than that. My name is Andrew. I own a couple of restaurants, pretty casual, neighborhood-oriented, sourced locally, based around warm carbohydrates that everybody likes.
You can emphasize good food.
The elevator pitch is we productize the HGTV experience for our customers. So you can think of it as Fixer Upper, I think is probably my favorite, with Chip and Joanna Gaines. It's like, hi, my name's Chad. This is my partner, Casey. And I like collect toothpicks for a living. And my partner like babysits kittens. We have $1 million budget. We'd like to do X, Y, and Z, and we have 6 weeks to do it. And then 43 minutes later, your house is beautiful, right? That's not how it happens in real life. And Angie's List and Home Advisor and a couple other people that I don't want to name yet because they might be listening. They're all lead generation sites. They're better versions of the Yellow Pages. So we wanted to create that same experience. Somebody comes to the website and says, I want a kitchen. I have this budget, and it needs to get done in 6 weeks. And then we match you to George. You can book them for 3 days from now, 3 weeks from now, 3 months from now, but everything's super transparent. Push a button, get a bathroom or kitchen, and everybody should go and do that now.
So just to give you a bit of background, everybody that is here today came from a different occupation before they started their own business. So Andrew was in business development at EverFi, as well as you were at Octagon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which we want to do Jerry Maguire, so basically sports management,
yep.
Right? So you did that career before you went and started a pizza business. And then, Monica, you were in nuclear non-proliferation, right?
Yes.
Before you leapt out and became a consultant, right?
Yes.
So I think everybody's got a really interesting background. I myself came from a corporate communications world, working for nonprofits and the private sector. And I think, let's just talk about the calling of being an entrepreneur. I think something happens in the process where people are dissatisfied with the current state of things. Or they realize they could do something better than someone else, or they just have a great idea that's burning so bright. So can we just talk about how everyone, you know, started their business, where the idea came from, and just discuss your origin story as an entrepreneur?
I'm going to start. So in my case, I started because I was depressed and stuck in a job I loved. If we met 5 years ago, I would have shared that my vision and what I wanted to do was be a diplomat. And that's all I cared. I pursued all my careers, my internships, my unpaid internships in DC. We can talk about that. And that traditional path of what it means to be building a career in that field. And I loved it. I still actually have huge respect, still have a lot of colleagues. And I actually use a lot of my knowledge in those work in my current work. But I knew for sure when I got depressed and I was seeing myself crying to work every day that something had to change. But I didn't know how. I didn't want to call somewhere. I did everything traditional of reading up resources and trying to attend things. But it was only until a certain day that I realized, you know, what would I do something different that would help me? And it actually started with a small habit, which was, what if I just changed my work routine? Because it's a little embarrassing to cry in the middle of the bus. So I actually decided to just take a long walk. I was like, oh, less people see me crying, or maybe it's going to be less awkward. But then it got me, interestingly, noticing different things, because now instead of like a bus ride and then walking to work, I would now be walking the entire way, which is waking up earlier, changing my morning routine, and then actually doing a 2-hour walk. And I shared that as an emphasis because I think that small act ended up leading to having the courage to start keep doing small things differently, which helped me recognize the importance of doing things differently in the routine, of recognizing the importance of a creative mindset, which is now the whole work I do, because not only did it help me, you know, rethink about my whole daily routine, but not perform better at work, do things differently, have the courage to speak up more, present different ideas. And so that only led me not only to get promotions, do better work, and as a result, recognizing that, wow, so this innovation and creativity jargon that everyone talks about, you can do it. You can do it in so many different ways, but you can actually, you don't need to have a title or have someone else tell you to do it to become one. We all have it in part of us. And in fact, when we don't do that, that's when we get deprived and feel stuck and depressed or whatever other negative feelings we feel. And so through that journey, I realized it's possible. But then once I figured that out, I realized, well, I know 87% of everyone else is stuck. What's a way I can help better? And I originally wanted to join a company, but I couldn't find it. And so that's kind of hence why I knew that I knew how much of a game changer it became for me. What can I do to help other people? And I didn't know all the solutions yet, but that's how I got into that journey of wanting to make that difference. So I'll pause there for now.
Excuse yourself. That's great. Thank you. Andrew.
That is very cool. Yeah, I'll start from the beginning. I, like, growing up, I never really had, like, a passion. I mean, I liked sports and I liked eating. I was sort of a fat kid, but I was never like, ooh, I want to be a doctor. And just growing up, I always felt like there just weren't that many options, right? It was like, you can go into marketing, you can be a lawyer. So I just was like, I don't want to do any of those things. And I kept going through the motions, and I would have an internship. I graduated college, and I sold windows. And I was like, this sucks. This definitely is not what's up.
It's not that bad. It's not that bad.
Actually, I think Chad's been there until alive.
It's pretty bad. And then I worked for a startup, and I was like, I'm going to go to grad school because I'll figure it out in grad school. Mm-hmm. So I went to get my MBA at Fordham, thinking I had like 2 years to figure it out. And like a month in, they're like, so you have to start applying for your summer internship. And I was like, shit, I haven't figured anything out. So I applied for a sports marketing sort of position at Octagon, did that for a while. Then I graduated, and I was still like, I just didn't have a passion. And everybody was graduating. I want to go into finance. I want to be an accountant. I want to do this. And just like something in the back of my head was saying, open a pizza restaurant. And I started to sort of spread that word. And I did my capstone project on it, oddly enough, at Fordham, but was way too scared to graduate with an MBA and say, I'm opening a pizza restaurant. I think everybody would have been like, what's wrong with you? So I went and worked for an education technology company, EverFi. And, you know, by all metrics, it went really well. I got promoted and probably made more money than I deserved and all this stuff. But I wasn't happy at all. And that voice in the back of the head kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And my boss kept getting worse and worse and worse. And then we just sort of hit this breaking point where I remember it was like February, and I was like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I got to do something else. And basically on a whim, just like said, I'm starting a pizza business. And like the guy basically who was sitting next to me at work, I was like, you coming with me? And he was just like, yeah, let's do it. And then I sort of continued to do a shitty job working there for 9 months while I started this business, and they didn't know that. And that's a much longer story about how to sort of keep one foot in and pay the bills while you're starting another business. And that's pretty much it. And that was 5 years ago. And, you know, we have 4 different spaces now, and we're going to do more stuff, and things are continue to roll. So awesome. All good. Yeah.
Now. Great. And we'll also seek into the last question too, which was, when did you find the calling that you wanted to start your own business? Because you came from, you were at OnlyFans prior to that, you were at Living Social.
Yeah. So contrary to you, growing up, I actually wanted to be a doctor. I think that's a little bit more causation versus correlation. So I'm a first generation American born to Caribbean parents. So it's like you go to church, you go to school, and then maybe you think about family. Like, that's the order of importance. So I was supposed to be a doctor, an engineer, or a lawyer. I went to the University of Maryland to study hematology originally. Like, I wanted to be a blood doctor. And then I was, BSI 105 was the equalizer. I was like, yeah, actually, I'm not a scientist. So I switched to business. That was way more interesting. Kind of going back to it, I guess, like, as a little kid, you know, remember when you sell, like, candy bars out of, like, those fundraisers? I was always the kid. So, you know, like, the first level is like, oh, you get a keychain. Like, the second level is like a t-shirt. And like the 12th level is like a trip to Disney World. I was a Disney World kid. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know how, it was just always interesting to me. I thought that it was cool that I could buy some candy from whoever for 10 bucks. And then when I'm done with the whole box, I ended up with 50. I was like, I like this. I'm part of the reason why FYE is out of business. Like, I burnt CDs. Like, I was the only kid on my block with a CDR drive. So I think that entrepreneurship kind of was in my cards, but yeah, I was supposed to be a doctor. and then how did I get to here? So first, I didn't graduate from Maryland. I left after my sophomore year. I basically looked at it, and I went to the dean of my school, and I said, you know, I'm having some trouble. I got cut from the track team. School's expensive, but I think I could figure this out. What would be the books that I would read if I were to matriculate over the next 2 years? Dean gave me all of them. Maryland's a public school, so every book that's assigned has to be in the library for free. So I was like, I'm out. I read all those books in like 6 months, and then I left. My first job was... out of school was at Aflac selling insurance. I was actually pretty good at that, but I hated the work. Like, there's nothing exciting about insurance. I actually prefer to watch paint dry. Then Living Social, that was cool because I don't know if you guys remember, but like 6 years ago, the entire city had a Living Social, some piece of swag, a backpack, a t-shirt. It was the thing. It was like the first unicorn since Blackboard. And how exciting was that, right?
Yeah.
So I worked at Living Social. I saw this two-sided marketplace. I worked at Long Fence. I sold windows. And I always thought that, you know, why we know how much the labor costs, we know how much the materials cost. Why can't somebody just call in and say, I want 10 windows? And we're like, it's 10 grand. They were like, oh, nobody will ever make a five-figure decision over the internet or over the phone. I was like, that's ridiculous. I just came from a company where, like, we sell excursions to Europe for $2,400, and they're the most popular vouchers we sell. So I call bullshit, but I was 23, and Dave Normandin, who I love dearly, was like, 50, 60 at the time. And I was like, you're a kid. I have shoes older than you. Go away. So then I didn't say, okay, I want to start Remodel Mate. Living Social, we got beat by Groupon, and I made it through three rounds of layoffs. And then I was like, if there's any time to do it, like, I would have loved to kind of do one foot in, one foot out. But I lost my job. And then I was like, okay, let's go see if we can build this thing. And I got attached to that idea of productizing the HGTV experience, making renovations predictable. First year we did really well, and I've been too stupid to stop since.
So do you remember whenever you first got the idea, whenever you came up with this idea for your startup, do you remember the moment when you thought, hey, this is something that's interesting, I want to do this?
Yeah, for me, it was 2015 November, and I always treat that as my company birthday. I never forgot it because I couldn't sleep. Like I would wake up in the middle of the night, and then every morning I would still wake up, and I'll get clearer visions of what that would look like. And I didn't have clarity on, like, who do I need to sell it to, who's my customer. Like, I know we need to think through all those other parts of the pregnant, but like that particular big vision of that North Star of like what this impact could mean, how I'm actually going to be part of that picture, that part just became so clear. And it was, I'm also Christian too, so for me, like, it was a faith of calling as well, and recognizing that, like, there's a reason why I feel like this is so something that I feel so attached, and it's something I personally experienced, and people have been starting to share with me that my story, and even my, even before I started my company, how that was helping them. And I'm like, well, let me do a little bit more study to find a more actual solution that I could help. And once I got into it, I keep getting that validation, because it's hard, like, to be transparent. There's many moments, actually, I feel like I've had to feel like maybe I should give up, because, like, it's hard.
Yes.
But then thank you for agreeing on that. Yeah. I feel like we don't talk enough about it. It's not about the start, but it's also throughout the journey. There's really hard to, and having that right reminder that is this calling not just like a whim, but something that actually is going to sustain you for the long run. And I think even now I would wake up and see, like, yes, things are horrible and hard sometimes, horrible in a way that I want to solve this so fast, but I can't. But exciting, because every small change and every small step I'm doing is getting a step closer to that bigger vision of helping more people each day.
I want to do a quick survey here. How many times have you all thought about giving up when you're in the process of your
this week transition? Or
this week?
Thank you.
I mean,
a lot. Like, yeah. So, I think that, so for us, our business is slightly cyclical. It's busier in the spring and in the fall, slower in the winter, in the summer. So, like, the summer months, like, every day, like, why did I do this? Like, I was making really good money before this, and now it's like, this hurts. So it happens more often then, but then there's other times when everything's going well and you're just tired. And I'm like, damn, I just want to sleep. Like, there are some people who, like, brag about grinding all the time and, like, or I'm like, no, it's not really that cool. I have trouble sleeping. Like, I wish I could sleep longer.
Everybody, how many hours do you work outside of what are kind of like the normal operational hours of your
what startup? Do you call normal hours anymore?
Normal
hours, 24 standard? Hours for an entrepreneur. When do you stop working, actually, is more of the
question. More of a traditional schedule, right?
I also live with my business partner and girlfriend, so it's sort of like all-consuming. It's like all we talk about all we think about. And early on, it was just like I was rolling every dough ball and mopping the floor. Now, thank God, we've sort of graduated from that a little bit. But we raised money very early on, and a lot of it was from friends and family. And so I had to totally block out the idea of like, oh, I can quit, because it's just like, these people would murder me, and I owe them just grinding to make it work. So, but I agree. It's more the fatigue that sets in than anything else, where and you just have to do it every day. It's not like when I was at EverFi, I would, like, not check my email for a week and then do the classic, like, oh, sorry, it was so busy. Like, oh, just you know, climbing out of this pile of emails. And, like,
don't check your email for a week, and you're, like, 150% over quota.
It's just every day. Every day is a day away.
Yeah.
You're just always grinding, so.
So you just talked about fundraising, and I think I want to talk about financing right now, because I think that's the burning question for a lot of people that want to do a startup. So how did you go about financing? Because you got a business partner pretty early on. You have Jeff Zients, who was...
That was his latest. So we've now raised money 3 times.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
We raised money originally for Timber Pizza. So we started the business as a food truck, personal savings. My business partner and I was like 30 grand. So we each put up 15.
Whatever. No biggie.
Yeah. I mean, it was like everything I had. I ended up living in my friend's baby's bedroom. So it's like, it was not a luxurious start. But then for Timber, we did it sort of the traditional restaurant route, where they call it 3 F's, friends, families, and fools. And we have a combination of that. And we just, like, I just, like, crawled and scratched every dollar. Like, we had never opened a restaurant. People didn't really believe in us. And just did, like, a classic restaurant waterfall deal where you pay them back first and then you get more equity back. Timber went sort of better than anybody could have ever hoped for, and money was made. And then I was introduced to a guy named Jeff Zients, a very successful businessman. He was Obama's director of economics.
Yeah.
And I sort of just, like, met him by habits. I didn't even know who he was when we first met. So like, the worst version of myself. And I was, like, talking shit.
Former director of the
and then I went home and Wikipedia him, and I was like, oh, no.
But that's usually the best kind of
no,
case.
No, I think he, like, appreciated
authentic.
That I kept it real.
You and, were being authentic.
And we, like, hit it off. So he funded the first round of Call Your Mother. And it's just gone like gangbusters the first 7 months. And we just did another round of money to build out a bagel factory. And we did that with him and some other people. So, yeah. And that the last two rounds have been more sort of like traditional business, not the restaurant waterfall deal, but mostly equity deals. Basically because I'm too scared to take money from a bank, because if that goes to shit, you're really screwed. Whereas with these super rich guys, you just sort of say, sorry.
It's funny with startups, because I don't think you can really go the traditional route of taking out a line of credit, right?
No, you can only get a line of credit once you've been successful. And at that point, you're like, no, I can get money in way better ways. So it's sort of,
It kind of lends itself to accredited investors a lot of times. Yes. Chad, you had a seed round. And you
Had a so the reason why I said no biggie to 30 grand is like, I wish. I wasn't trying to be funny. So I started the company with $8,000. That was my severance package from Living Social. I built a landing page on startups.co for $60. And then it wasn't even really an application. It was like a landing page that went to a scheduling tool that went that used a Zap to notify me on Slack. Like, that was the first version of the app. And that cost me like, I don't know, maybe $200 altogether. And then I literally spent $3,000 on Facebook ads and got my first like three customers. So there are a lot of companies that, so like Twitter, for example, didn't make money for like 7 years. I didn't have 30 grand laying around. So I was like, I need to make money immediately. We make 20% on every transaction. And then I just kept reinvesting the cash into Facebook and Instagram ads. It was the one thing that I knew I was good at outside of everything else. Like, the website was shitty. The calendar tool, I'm not technical, none of that stuff. So everything else was terrible, but I knew I could sell. And then the first year we did $69,000 in top line sales, put 15 grand in the bank. So I was like, I doubled my money. Like, you know, I'm playing with house money, right? So might as well keep going. And then I ran into my co-founder. His name is John Amar. He worked at Levick, JBG Smith. This is actually one of the buildings that he supported in his position as a PR director. And he was like, I want to sign you as a client. And I was like, no, I just need someone to do this full time for me. And he was like, yeah, no way. Like, you're this little punk ass startup. You couldn't pay for like my travel expenses for this. I was like, you're right. So then he's still trying to pitch me. He's like, what are you going to do? Like, who's your customer? And I described him, young, just engaged, just got married, just bought your first house, and the kitchen or the bathroom sucks. And he was like, all right, let's do my kitchen over. Had a great experience there. And he was like, all right, I know that you're going to pay me dog shit, but I'm in. And then that year, we did $854,000 in sales, 10x the business. And then one of my investors is here today. I don't know if he wants me to introduce him, but if you're here, you'll know who he is. So then I went out to raise money. I said, you know, I figured out sales, marketing, operations. It's actually a real app now. And I said, hey, I think that with like $500,000, I could get to this point. And so far, we've been executing on that plan really well.
That was the co-venture round?
Yeah, that was the co-venture round.
You got what, $525,000?
$525,000. Co-venture led that round with $160,000. MIT Angels of DC put in about $100,000. And then who else is notable? And then actually, it's just a bunch of individual angels after that. Mm-hmm. My next biggest group is just a bunch of real estate guys who are like, I get this. I own 12 properties myself and I have a title business. And then six of those guys came together and put in another $100,000. And then everything else was just scratching and clawing. Mm-hmm. But it's helped, right? So before we raised money, we probably were doing 5 or 6 projects a month. As of yesterday, we booked 22 projects. And we just closed that round like 4 months ago. So,
great.
You know, the business has already tripled in size. And hopefully that keeps happening because I'll go raise some more money and do it again.
Great. Monica?
Yeah, my story will be slightly different because I'm still bootstrapping. I'm only starting to look into raising funding now. And it's more because of the type of business. And that's part of been actually both the challenge and the opportunity I found. So I realized quickly as I was starting my business, I don't have an app. You know, a lot of it right now is going to be really reliant on me. And as we're looking into scale and sustainability, we've been thinking a lot about this. But I didn't want it to push that from the beginning when I knew that that would be just to, for the sake of publicity and not really for the value. Like, I wanted to really hack and figure out what is the true value of the work we're providing. And so I've been able to prove that with a large number of the corporation gigs and the projects that we've been doing. So now, you know, some of our clientele include like PepsiCo, Citibank, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Booz Allen. And so we have a range of different corporations as well as universities and clientele who work with us, who's sharing that like, wow, like we work with many folks, but it has not happened. And so we are at the next growth stage. But going back to like some of still the money hack that I'm still thinking through for those who's thinking about bootstrapping, they like one, there is still various strategies, and you don't have to just immediately need to think about like if you can't get investor money or like get those fast, like your first priority should always be get your customers. So like completely agree, like whatever money budget you have, your first priority should always be get your customers, understand who your customers are, and like sell them and let them know, find the people who's going to love your stuff. Because at the end of the day, even if you get investors' money, that's like one round of skill. If you can't deliver the work to your customers, sorry, that's not a business. Yeah. Yeah. And so I was very adamant about trying to stay at my day job as long as possible as well. So I stayed at least 7 to 8 months. I only left because I ran out of vacation days to do the work. And so had to let go. But that permitted me to test out as much as I can, use the vacation days I had left and my job to do any business trips. And so that helped me plan that out a little bit. Have we figured it out? No, I'm still learning. In fact, probably taking notes as they're sharing their insights as well. But I hope to at least give an example that you don't have to just wait for one example of investor round of money to start your business. Like, start pockets. Don't just quit your job also. Like, unless you have a opportunity where it's like, hey, you know what, like I've, you know, been in a situation I just have to do it, that's great. But I strongly discourage folks who's like, I have a job, and if it's a choice of should I just quit it because I have this idea, I'm like, no, start incubating, talk to people, test out as much as you can, but don't, because you're going to be stressed already and going to have to problem solve all the time. Do you really need to add that money stress on top of that? Wait a little bit longer if you can.
Which, right, the side hustle route, too.
Yeah.
Or his weekends, basically.
Yes, and actually it then teaches you your time management skill a lot better. And actually, so the next phase of advice I actually give, which I think people forget beyond just the money, is the time aspect of how you manage in your mental health. Because I would now say, I'm now 3.5 years, so still learning through some of the things. And what I found is that it was actually my first 6 months of leaving my job to be the harder one than the following 1.5 years, because just I feel like now I have more time, I should get more stuff done. I'm like, why are things not happening fast enough? And that expectation and like delivery caused me to be stressed. I was stressing myself more out than I should have. And it was only when I started letting go of like, you know what, yes, I should take breaks, because if I'm tired, I can't deliver the work. Yeah. And I'm over promising things. Yeah. Were you about to add something?
I was going to add that raising money, I think, has been over-popularized lately. So I share your sentiment that I was, like, scared that, like, if this goes wrong, like, everybody's going to hate me, which is why I bootstrapped for so long. But I think the other thing is that you should raise – I think people raise money when they don't have money, and really you should raise money when you've figured out how to create money. Money should be, so if you've built a rocket, then money is rocket fuel. A lot of people want money to build the rocket, and it's like, well, are you a pilot? Like, have you built rockets before? Like, why should I give you $500,000? I think the way that I look at it is, if you go back, I'm a music guy. If you go back 20 years, the way that people got signed was they put together a demo tape and then say, like, listen to my rhymes, like, I'm dope, right? Sign me so that I can book studio time and tour dates and all this other shit. Today, you have 17-year-old kids in their mother's bathroom recording themselves on Snapchat, Instagram, TV, YouTube, SoundCloud, building these audiences, and then they come to the, some of them are, like Chance the Rapper, for example, he's avoiding deals. He's like, what do I need you for? I've got my own distribution. Like, so you want to give me $1 million now and then take 10% of all my proceeds forever? I'm good. So I think that as entrepreneurs, you have to think like that, right? You shouldn't raise money to prove the concept. You should prove the concept and then use money to do it faster, longer, in more places. It's also going to make you a tougher entrepreneur. Like there's a company that's popped up that's close to what we do. The founders are previously from Rent the Runway and Casper. They raised $4 million out of the gate, and on their website, it consistently says that they can't book a project for 4 months. And I'm like, they're not stressed because they're like, I got $4 million in the bank. I have $400,000 in the bank. So I'm like, if you want to book today, we can start today. So I wouldn't raise money right out of the gate.
That goes to a whole other conversation too about burn through rates and you know, what happens when you accept like these large investments. Like, who are you beholden
their
to?
They're large expectations. Yeah. And I think that
it's no longer just your company.
That's true too. But I mean that is still my goal, right? I want to build a big company. But I think the thing that's like hard is you can't serve two masters or three masters, right? So you have customers, employees, investors, friends, family, girlfriends or boyfriends. It's like, how many other people do you want to like have to manage expectations on? My investors know that like I care about my customers first. I feel like if I make them happy, they'll make all of us money, and that's good for you guys. But there are some people who raise money and then they're like beholden to their investors, and it throws the business off. So I wouldn't do that right out of the gate.
Yeah, Monica, you started talking about sales there, and I wanted to actually jump back on top of that because I think sales is the fundamental drive of any kind of sustainable business. So since it's the most important thing that we can probably talk about, like, where do most of your customers from? How did you kind of envision like where your customers would come from when you started, and how did you find them? And then whenever you're building kind of your minimum viable product, did you know what those customers are like, or is it actually different customers that you saw?
So all great questions, and actually kind of connects to one additional comment I wanted to piggyback. And so if I may actually answer that and then connect to the sales, which is for those who are probably listening to that comment and like, well, like, but I don't have a lot of money. I don't know. I don't have something to start selling. I want to still say to answer you, you can still sell your minimal viable product, which is like a small test version. And so even
collect traction.
Have a starting point. And I would say that that's actually all key part of your entire sales cycle, because it's not just about like having, let's say actually, so for instance, even if it's like something that requires hard tech, such as, you know, maybe building out an app. You can't maybe build it overnight, but there's still small segments that you can test out. And there's like lots of videos online that gives examples of how they even just like tested out little pictures and like seeing how people respond. Like, even if their customers were a baby, but then their buyers were parents, they would like try out these little picture cards. I'm like, oh, the baby's reacting. This is why parents, you should be buying this. And like, that's how you start getting money first, even if you don't have the app ready for the kids and the parents to use. And so that's a small example. In my case, being actually a service-based company, I was able to start immediately because my core delivery was me speaking and then doing workshops. And so as long as I had the energy and the creative juices to create those together, then I had to think about, hence the sales cycle and who my customers were. So are they the same customers that I thought 3 years ago and who I am now? A little different. Mm-hmm. I would say certainly I've educated myself and my audience as well and who they are. But they are the right direction. It's just that I knew a little less of their details. And one thing that I found to be really helpful is just, one, keeping always clear about the why. I think helps me remember when I meet potential customers as well as people who might be my potential clients to see if they align. Because even if they might be a great fit on paper, if they don't align with my value, if they don't align with the ultimate why of why they actually want to make this change, why would they want to work with me to have this culture and team management change, then it's actually not a good fit. Even if they give me $1 million, I mean, that's nice, but like neither of us are going to be happy yet. And so... that's one part of the cycle that I found actually in my sale process to be really important, of focusing on the why and the values. And then number two, just finding patterns. So year one to two, I think I just started attending as many different events and conferences, trying to both join online different groups to just really understand, because you only know what you know and you don't know what you don't know. So what's the fastest way I can expand my known than by expanding what I can learn? So attending a lot of conferences, finding niche. If I find success, then I keep going back to it. If I don't, then I stop going. If I find people who says, hey, you should show up here and speak here, then I go. And if I don't find success, then I stop going. So I keep repeating that cycle. And then you quickly realize there's circles of communities that are true advocates, that fits within your business model, and others that don't. In my case, that was supplier diversity, which is a whole niche of how, for instance, in corporations and government entities want to figure out how to work with diverse business owners to be a great entryway for me and find the right allies. That also meant certain communities who have affinity groups who actually want to help their team development in a different way. And then third, also certain communities who were tackling next gen problems on generational gaps. Mm-hmm. Were they all in one bucket? No, I had to do a lot of research and showing up.
But that is your research process, right?
But that is part of the process and just staying open-minded.
Yeah. But I think Andrew wanted to jump in.
Yeah, so. Please. Sorry if I missed.
No. I had something. I was going to go back on the fundraising piece for a second.
Oh, okay.
Knock you out.
Yeah, so one then final thing before you jump back onto that is, I think along the way, what I also learned is equally important to manage your energy and health, because no matter, so give an example. Right now, I'm about to start in a whole month of traveling, and I'm very intentional about how I'm now going to spend my energy and time, because even if this conference, let's say that I'm going to be in Baltimore, particularly if I'm meeting like hundreds of people, maybe about 100 of them, about maybe 30 people in particular might be my potential clients. Out of that, maybe about 10 could be that big project that I'm waiting to do. If I'm tired by the time I show up to that event, I'm not going to deliver that conversation, that communication. So
you were just
don't
try
to
Korea,
book all your...
I just
came back from Korea as well. And so actually before coming to this, and I was intentional about this week planning as well, like who are the people that I would meet? Who are the people to say I'm available in 3 months later? To really be mindful of that, because you cannot be there for everyone. So yes, there might be three events that will be really key, but you're going to have to start prioritizing of like this event, you're going to have to send with someone else. You're not going to show up because you cannot be everywhere just because it says it's great, because actually now you're only providing half of your energy. And if you really want to be effective, especially in this kind of sales service, like you're going to have to be 100% so that people understand what you're providing.
Energy,
so that's part of the, I think, lesson that I learned. It's not just about the sell tactics and the communication and feedback and follow-up. It's, are you actually present to have that conversation?
I also think like some success allows for that, right? Like early on when we were a food truck, our whole motto was just show up.
Right.
We said yes to everything just because like we were nobodies. And it's like you sort of have to learn, like earn that, where you can sort of pick and choose and say some no's. But like for the first year and a half, like legit, we said yes to everything. We were at like swimming pools in Gaithersburg. Like we were just like, sure, we'll sell pizza.
Right.
And so it's like you sort of have to earn that, I think. And then on the fundraising thing, just quickly, I think you guys are right, but I don't think that like raising money is inherently bad. It's sort of like what pigs get fed and hogs get slaughtered. It's more about just like remaining bootstrappy. And there are times you have to raise money, but like we have always raised sort of the bare minimum, and that's worked for us, because sometimes you do need money to build products or start companies. But it is about don't raise that cushy amount like you were talking about, where then you sort of can take that deep breath. I haven't taken a deep breath in 5 years. So it's like you just remain bootstrappy and scrappy and raise sort of the bare minimum to get you to that next level.
Yeah, kind of like the lean startup concept too.
Yeah. Just
keeping it with that, you know, vision that you're
100%.
Keep it lean. Excellent. So I wanted to talk about something about the entrepreneur mindset, because Chad touched upon this earlier on when he talked about when he was at UMD and basically saw that the opportunity cost of going to college for 4 years was not worth, you know, just, you know, clamping down the energy he had to start his business. So let's talk about that mindset of being an entrepreneur. What do you think actually like happens inside the gray matter that makes it different, and how you think different than other people? How did you get to that point, and how did you actually find as an entrepreneur that you're able to think differently than most people think about how the world works?
My older sister dropped me when I was 5 months old, and I'm convinced that's what it was.
Not a radioactive spider then.
Yeah. That would have been cooler. Not to be serious. So the first thing I want to say is that if you're in school, then you shouldn't leave school unless you have a plan. I had a plan. That's the only reason why it made sense. I'm not going back to school, though, because, like you said, the opportunity cost was too much, right? So I don't know what it is about the brain chemistry, but I'll go back. So one of my favorite quotes about entrepreneurship is, entrepreneur is a French word for crazy. And I think that that is true in the sense that I always am trying to look for something that doesn't make sense. So it's not so much that, like, I think I'm a smart person or a good businessman. I think that I'm just consistently curious about why things happen the way they do. So I looked at it and I said, I'm originally from Harlem. I wanted to go to school to make money. And then I did an internship at Aflac where I figured out how to make money, and they didn't care if I had a degree or not. So I was like, well, this is kind of stupid now. And then it was like $40,000 a year. I loved the University of Maryland, by the way. Like, that's probably, I would go back to school if they paid for it, but I'm not paying for it. I would go back. I just don't want to pay for it. And then I was like, $40,000, don't want to pay $40,000, or do I want to go and make $40,000? And then I was like, what's the trade-off? And, like, I wonder if I spent 20 credit hours over the next 13 weeks or 15 weeks, could I make more than 40 grand? It was an all-commission position, and I just looked at that math, and I was like, that just makes more sense to me. The other thing is, I think that if you have to, like, if you want to be a doctor, like, you need to go to school. Like, absolutely. If you want to practice law, you need to learn how to, like, create arguments and defend arguments, right? But you don't need to go to school to be a business person. Like,
so you don't think there's value in an MBA?
I think MBAs are designed to teach you how to operate a large business. So if you want to be a COO or a CFO of, like, Citibank or, like, Goldman Sachs, yeah, you should go get an MBA. But if you're going to build a company and get from zero to one, an MBA doesn't teach you how to do that.
Yeah.
All the MBAs that I'm...
The corporate world, really. This is how people use it or treat it.
Yeah, all the MBAs that I know...
MBA, right? And I tell people, do not get an MBA unless you know exactly what you want to do.
Yeah.
The only thing that getting an MBA did for me was give me confidence, because I went there and, like, I was like, all these jabronis who are going into, like, the finance and stuff, I was like, I sort of am just as smart as them. And so I wouldn't say I, like, learned anything about business, but it gave me a confidence.
Yeah.
And then to piggyback on what Chad is saying, I think there's, like, a million ways to come into entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
I'm, like, the exact opposite. I had zero entrepreneurial bones in my body. I wanted somebody to give me money. I wanted structure and all that stuff. And I just, like, wasn't happy. And so it was, like, baby step by baby step. And it was sort of this evolution where I quit my job and started a pizza business because I hated my job. It wasn't because I was like, ooh, I see these opportunity costs or anything like that. It was like,
that's what I think, like, is dope about it.
Yeah.
Is that you're just like, so he's like, I like pizza. And I think I could sell a better pizza than anybody on the planet. And he's like, you didn't go to, like, talk to your professors and you were like, I'm going to go open a food truck.
Never took a pizza lesson. And then just, like, every day,
done.
You gain a little confidence and you learn a little more and you start to believe in yourself. And then you have employees and you realize they're looking at you and you're like, oh shit, I guess I'm the one who's supposed to figure this out. And it just sort of, like, and it becomes this snowball effect where it gets bigger and bigger. And now it's 5 years later and, like, I do sort of,
oops,
I believe, yeah. And, like, I believe in my instincts more now than
you
I did 5 years
expert.
Ago. And I'm like, oh yeah, I guess I am an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got here.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm also different because I didn't grow up ever thinking that I'll be an entrepreneur. I think if someone joked, I'll say, yeah, maybe, but maybe after, like, when I'm a lot older, when I have money,
yeah,
you know, things figured out. The other thing is, though, now that I am walking this talk and I meet a lot of other entrepreneurs, I'm also teaching entrepreneurship, talking about school. I am also an adjunct professor. And so I understand both pros and cons, but I think, you know, there's a lot of learning, and I still do like school, though it was expensive. I agree on that. But you don't have to go to school to become an entrepreneur. You can.
I don't think you have to go to school to be a lifelong learner either.
Yes, that's what I agree. I think the value more is like being a life, understanding the importance of learning. If you are someone like that, then yeah, school is somewhere where you do that additionally, but you don't have to go to school to become one. Like, I think that's the equation that's really important to note. But what I found as a result, going back to actually my number one class I actually teach, my first lesson in my entrepreneurship class I teach, is actually the importance of the differentiation between an entrepreneur versus an entrepreneur mindset. And mm-hmm. I emphasize this actually, and I'm so glad we're talking about this, because there's actual patterns, even though we all take different paths, and it's that ownership, that confidence that grows over time, that genuine curiosity, that genuine wanting to make this better than anyone else in the world, and knowing that that person is you, and just really like waking up each day and realizing that this is the best thing I know still in the world, and I want to do it again. And there's a bit of an itch where like, yeah, I could, like, I mean, sometimes when I did freak out about like my status of like, okay, that quit situation of like, do I have to give up? The question is like, okay, what would it look like if I actually had to go in a day job? And I'm like, nah, I think this would be a little bit better than for me to deal with. And I think if I talk with non-entrepreneurs who don't have that mindset, they don't see that. I'm like, wait, no, that's crazy. Going back to that crazy aspect. But I think the mindset is so much more than just being an entrepreneur, because I also meet a lot of people who are in corporations who have this mindset. So I think that's another angle to keep in mind. And lastly, to add another note, a friend of mine shared this as an entrepreneur. To understand an entrepreneur's mindset, it's just trying to ask, see that employees usually have to struggle making decisions every day with 80% information. Entrepreneurs make decisions every single second on 2% information. That's why it's crazy. But that's why it's also really exciting and humbling.
That's a great quote. And I think it's also interesting, too, just to differentiate about entrepreneurial mindset versus employee mindset. Because I think when you're an employee, there's a very different kind of sense of when you're going into work, you don't have as much autonomy or ownership, really, in what you're doing. But as an entrepreneur, you really have a lot more leeway into, you know, leading things and driving how you want to see the business go forward.
Well, that's what you feel. And that's why I think I emphasize the word mindset, because you can actually learn to have that even if you're in companies. That's the fine line that I think it gets interesting. So I've met also both a lot of people, but that's part of the thing that I think needs to happen more. More companies recognizing that it's not that you need to lose all these amazing people. Like, what? Figure out a way so that they can feel like they can do all these things. Like, don't you want to have someone who wants to, like, hey, I want to build pizza? Like, that's great. Like, we want you to stay in this company. We'll give you resources and, like, build these pizza company. Why have them all let go? Like, actually, we could actually have a better economy when more of those actually could also stay in corporations and not necessarily same in the school system.
And having entrepreneurship too.
Yes.
We have about 5 minutes left here too, so I just ask a couple quick questions just to kind of round things out. What do you know now that you've already started your business that you wish you knew when you started? And if you had the chance to do things over again, would you do them the same way? So we'll just start with Andrew here.
I just wish I had known how much time it was going to take. I mean, like, truly, like, the restaurant business is like, it is like a big ship, and it's like slow moving, and it's like so much grunt work in it. And there's just like, there's things that you just can't delegate at the beginning. And I missed weddings, I missed birthday parties, I lost friends, all that stuff, but I wouldn't change a thing, and I would do it again because it finally is like paying off. But, I think everybody has this sort of like romantic idea. I'm going to own a restaurant and I'll like be out there shaking hands with customers and it's going to be awesome. And it's like the exact opposite for the first 2 years, where it's like you're in the back like just killing yourself. And like people are like, oh, come say hey. And you're like, I can't fucking come say hey.
For what?
Burning shit. What are you talking about? So I just wish somebody had prepped me a little more how hard it was going to be, but I wouldn't change a thing. It's been awesome.
Yeah. I think we've also seen like that whole narrative now driven where it's like, it's like sexy to be an entrepreneur. You're like Mark Zuckerberg or somebody. You're like, you know,
Elon Musk. Yeah.
Yeah, Elon Musk, whatever. It's become kind of like the new rock star, really, if you think about it.
I
don't think it's like that in reality.
No, everybody wants to like fast forward to the C-suite or the mogul. And like the only way there is like through the fucking wall is what I say. And like it's hard, but you got to go through that wall. And it's like...
So full Kool-Aid man, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Let's go ahead and do some interesting lightning round questions here, because Monica brought these cards from her consulting business called Spark, and we're going to do some kind of random cards here, random questions here. And I think
can I go live on this?
What's that?
Can I go live with this?
You're going to live stream?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, so there's different categories. Should I read the category too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, please.
So here's a question about curiosity. What do you value most in a friendship? And we'll go with you because these are your cards. So
I value honesty, consistent honesty, and then growth.
Growth. Growth over time through the friendship. Mm-hmm. Great. Love it.
Yeah, I was just going to say realness. Like, I don't need people hyping me up and telling me I'm the man. I need people keeping it real and saying, dude, that pizza sucked tonight. Like, get back on your game.
For me, it would... So, we're live with DC Entrepreneur, by the way. So, we're
get
doing,
the banner in there.
Yeah, I'm going to. So, we're getting lightning... This is the lightning round of the podcast. What do I value in friendship the most? I would say unconditional love. I know that's probably a weird way to answer the question, but I think I have like 10 friends in the world, and I've known all of them for more than a decade. Mm. I say unconditional love because I'm a screw up, so I don't like fair weather friends. I need you to be around when like I totaled your car or something. Like we still need to be friends. And I only ask what I expect to give.
Yeah.
So
someone's got your back there. All right. So next question. How would your day be different if you were blind?
Heavy doses of Xanax. I honestly, that gives me so much anxiety. I'd have a dog that would take me around, and more help, and I probably sure. wouldn't have opened a pizza restaurant. I don't know. That would suck.
Sorry, different business.
Yeah, different business for sure. Audiobook business.
Yeah. Problem solving already.
My day would be very different. That's a question.
You're welcome.
I listen to a lot of music, but I also like pace a lot. I take sales calls and or like meeting with partners a lot, and I pace. So I'd probably just be very bruised up. I can't sit still when I'm on the phone. I can't sit still now. So I would just be walking back and forth and tripping over stuff if I was blind.
Yeah, I have to change a lot of my routines. Mm-hmm. Can't do a lot of things that I used to do, but
yeah.
Hugely relying on people, but then also learning very creative ways to not rely on people, because if you've been living like that for a long time, it's very different, very humbling.
So what experience changed the way you define love?
Oh, you picked all the very hard ones.
I know,
ones
right?
I did make all those questions.
Should I talk about love? You can answer that one.
I'm sorry. Ask the question again. These are deep. Like,
I know that's getting really deep here.
Next, you're gonna ask me like, listen to my like iTunes, and I'm like, whoa, we just met.
here's one right here. If you came from the year 3200, what would surprise you most about the way we live today?
Traffic jams.
Air travel.
Towards the future, right?
Yes, going forward.
Yeah, the fact that like everybody at the same time goes to work and then at the same time leaves work and like sits in traffic for an hour seems like the most asinine idea ever.
I hope it's gone by 3200.
Yeah, it's like ridiculous.
So this is, we're in the year
future
3000 something and we came back to this time.
Yeah.
That we have phones. I truly believe, like if Steve Jobs was still alive, I think that by now AirPods, Apple glasses, and the watch would be it. We would have gotten rid of the phone already. Mm. So I think 100 years from now, everything's going to be voice. What? So I'd be like, what the hell is that thing in your pocket that you, or like that you're attached to?
Are we still scrolling in the year 3200, right?
With eyeballs.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, okay.
It's like, oh, hello.
There's going to be a lot of weird facial expressions going on. It's like, are you looking at me? Like, it happens now with the AirPods. I'm having a full-blown conversation on 8th Street, and somebody's like, that guy's nuts. And I'm like, I'm on the phone. They're like, I thought you were just showing off. It's like, no, shut up, leave me alone. That's what I think is gonna happen. Like 2000 years from now, people are gonna be walking around like bumping into each other because they're doing a Google search and not paying attention to what's in front of them.
Augmented reality or something. Yeah. Monica, do you have an idea?
And to add that, since I travel a lot, I think air travel I think about how much time I spent just showing up. Like, one day, I think we'll just open the door, and I'm like, oh, here you go. Okay, I'll be back in Korea. Okay, let me wait a second. Right. Oh, you know what? I forgot something. Let me go back and come back.
Right.
Like, the fact that I spend, like, 15 hours, like, on top of traffic and, like, just waiting at the airport and then fly somewhere and then get off, like... We're going to look back and like, you know what? That was kind of stupid. We just
really
lost.
Inefficient. I mean, could you imagine 2,000 years ago, they didn't have like cars.
Yeah.
So they're probably like, damn, he can get to New York in like 4 hours. That used to take us 7 days. So then.
Now it takes 2 seconds.
Yeah, 2,000 years from now, they're probably going to be like.
What?
You have to get to the airport an hour and a half before a domestic
flight.
3 hours
if it's international
so
right now.
Transportation has been kind of the theme and technology.
And there's not enough innovation there still.
Yeah. So I'm going to go ahead and open up the floor to questions. If you have a question, please feel free to ask it of our guests here. I'll open it up to anyone right now. If you want to actually use my microphone here, you're welcome to do so.
So my question...
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Either distracted.
When did you know you needed to hire employees? And then we just talked about the employee mindset and the entrepreneur mindset and being an entrepreneur as well. Like, how did you distinguish that between, like, you know, the people you had to bring on to help you build on this vision?
I mean, we still struggle. We have 70 employees now, and we still struggle with that. It's like the most like chicken and egg question, where it's like, if we hire this person, we can get to this level, but we're going to sort of be out of pocket. So there's not like a great answer for that. The first employees we hired, like, we were going to die if we did. Like, literally, we were rolling every dough bowl, going to every pizza market, making every pizza, cleaning every single thing. We just like couldn't be everywhere. So it was out of necessity. But we're like still honing in on that. And it's like, there's always these weird gaps, right? Where it's like, all right, we're a little understaffed, but now we're going to be overstaffed and our labor's going to go up. And so we're still honing in on that 70 employees later, which is crazy. So,
Don't have that many people yet. But the thing that I found is that, especially because of the type of business model that we're at, which is a little different, and on top of the challenges, is just finding the right people that you can align with. So a lot of the work, we don't have a physical office. Like, we don't have a physical space showing up. So for me, having autonomy... someone who's very clear on communication, someone who's comfortable speaking up and saying like, hey, this document is missing, and not waiting until the next day. I'm like, oh, you know what? That attachment was still missing. And then I'm like, well, we could have told me to like earlier when you saw that email. So someone who's comfortable with that, what I found over time is that regardless of age, gender, or ethnicity or background, there's certain people who are more comfortable with that and certain people are just not. So I've had some failed experiences, some like could have been better experiences that helped me figure out a little bit early on. And I sometimes actually take the approach of trying to scare off people at the beginning. I'm like, hey, I'm the nice friendly person, but if we're working together, you got to see my other side of being able to deal with it. Because if you can't work through it and you're not going to be intimidated, I need to find that person, because I'm going to be more ambitious when you get to work together, but I need someone who's going to be excited about it, not be like scared and worried about it. Like, you got to be comfortable that even if I send you late emails, that I'm not expecting you to reply now. It's just that I'm so excited I'm sending you an email now, but you'll reply probably tomorrow. Like, be comfortable with that. And so I try to set better expectations. Do I do a good job all the time? No. I've still had people who are like, no, that's not it. And we had to part, but I've learned to try to do different approaches every time from my past lesson learned to, if it's not a good fit, let's find that out as fast as we can. If it's a good fit, how do we train you up and do things like that? But I think it helped at least the few who have been involved. They've stayed.
No,
I didn't scare them off
a
yet.
A second to think, too. I have a better answer. It also depends, like, where you are in the business. Like,
yes.
With Timber, we're just trying to squeeze every dollar of profit out of it at this point. So we try and stay lean and mean. So we only hire if it's, like, totally out of necessity. Whereas Call Your Mother, we want everybody in the world to be eating Call Your Mother bagels one day. So we're like, okay, being a little more bloated. So we're more apt to like hire there because it's creating a stronger foundation to grow. Or at Timber, we're sort of like, screw the foundation. Let's get those dollars.
So I don't, I'd like to say that I don't know if I've hired an employee yet. I try to find founders that weren't there on August 27th. They're co-founders that just weren't there on day one. But when do I decide to go look for my next co-founder? It's usually, so we're an East Coast company, but we try to stick to the West Coast mantras as much as possible. So we literally do things that don't scale at every point of the, before we iterate on the product. So we tested a service called Concierge, where it's basically like you could get, if RemodelMate matches you to Chip Gaines, then Concierge is being able to add on Joanna and do the design and procurement side of the renovation. We tested that for 6 months, where it was me and John. And then when we noticed that like 70% of the people over that 3 then 6 month period of time were opting in, we were like, shit, what if this keeps happening and we do like 10 jobs, then we can't do this anymore. And then Logan reached out to us cold email and was like, I heard about Concierge. I come from Davis and I want to run that department. And I was like,
Davis Construction?
Yeah. Nice. And I was like, all right, you start on Monday. And so, yeah, it's usually if we're not, so the team, we look at it like this. If we're not willing to do something manually, it's either an idea that we don't really believe in or it's something that we don't care about. Like, we don't think that it's going to be a multiplier on the business. And then as soon as that becomes, like, painful, then we try to automate that process so that no human is necessary, or we figure out who's the best person to own that thing.
Great. Any other questions? Kirsta?
I feel so weird. My question is, I think one of the things that keeps people in their job that they hate is they're afraid of not having healthcare, 401k, dental, vision, life insurance. How do you plan for the future, or I guess combat that fear, or convince someone like it's worth the risk to try Obamacare, or, you know, don't worry about the 401k? I guess, how do you guys deal with that, and what do you all do for the benefits that you do have to have, like insurance?
Great question.
The reason I kept one foot in the door at EverFi as long as possible. So I used to travel for work for EverFi, so I was out of the office a lot, and then I just stopped traveling, but I was out of the office a lot and they thought I was traveling, so that's why I stayed there for so long.
Jem, somebody write that down.
Now they're listening.
But I was not insured for a year, and I had no money, and legitimately like squatted in friends' basements, and maybe there's a better way, and maybe people have a stronger sort of whatever network to do that with, but I could see the future, and I was like, I just got to suck it up, and hopefully I don't get super sick this year. And I just did it, and just sort of held my breath and crossed my fingers, and legit slept in a room that was my friend's baby's room. It was very weird. There was a crib in there, but I did it. And eventually came out, and we were able to get health insurance, and now we offer health insurance to all our employees and all that stuff, so we've come full circle. But there is sort of this mucky gray area where you just sort of got to hold your breath and say, F it, I'm jumping.
I like stories, if you guys haven't noticed. So something that's interesting that happens in the wild is that birds, like chicks, the ones that don't learn to fly are the ones that don't try. So you literally cannot get like the bone density, whatever science that you need as a small baby bird to fly unless you fall out of a tree over and over and over again. So I think that in that vein, right, that my answer is that like I kind of just was like, there's never going to be a good time to be broke for 2 years, live in your friend's nursery or decide that you're going to go on a conference road trip for a month. You can't plan for that. You kind of just have to be willing to like get some scar tissue. I think that the other thing is that like if you're an entrepreneur, you'll literally figure those things out as you go. And I think part of it is also you have to kind of believe your own bullshit before you start. Mm-hmm. So part of me was like, do I want a 401k or do I want to like count $401,000, right? Like, I just think that I don't want to be safe. And like, it's easier to be risky when I don't have kids, I don't have a mortgage, I don't have a car note. Like, when, if not now, then when?
Yeah, certain factors, right?
Yeah. And if you have those things, I don't care. You should still do it now. Like, because there's always going to be something else that you could buy that's going to make it harder 6 months from now or a year from now. I think that you should start, and you'd be surprised. Benefits. So my team has benefits now, but...
Well, I'm going to cut you off just a moment because I want to get Monica before we finish up here.
Cool.
Yeah.
To connect it to that, another analogy that I like to always think is the glass half full and half empty. Like, it's the same scenario.
I just want
to
sell you ice. Like, I don't...
Now you don't want even the water. So, but I completely agree because one, even now, like I don't have a consistent income because of the way our business cycle is, and we're actually still looking into kind of adjusting that scenario. So it is scary. And I think under saying that it's not scary is not true, but it's just changing the way you think about it. It's interesting that while I have that, oh, I've not had a regular paycheck ever in my life, I am still so much happier than I've ever been in my life. Yeah. And it's something hard to explain to my friends who get regular paychecks. Like, what do you mean you're happier? Like, you're still trying to figure out what to spend in the next day. I'm like, yeah, but living happier means so much more value. And I told you I was depressed and stuck in my job, and I've, you know, crying to work. I know what that felt. And knowing that I was changing the way I was thinking through it in my lifestyle, and I'm helping other people do that and getting unstuck. Like, yeah, that's going to take me not have some of those benefits, but I think it's less sad than my previous life of what it was like, and knowing that I can make that small difference. That's what keeps me going. But also staying open-minded that, you know, if I actually had that opportunity to do that within a company, I might not have necessarily needed to leave. But my particular company, I mean, I couldn't do that in nuclear nonproliferation, so that was a little different story. But that's why I push. Like, I do think, if corporations think about, like, hey, if you're listening as a company or in the government space, like, don't see that your people are leaving. Like, are there opportunities? Are you in liberty where you can create that space to let those people not feel like leaving is only the opportunity to ignite their different mindset? Can you do that within? And actually, there's some companies doing that, which is great. I think more I can.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Thanks so much, everybody, for being here. I want to thank all the guests, Monica Kang, Andrew Dana, Chad Hall. Thanks for being speakers. Give it up for them, please. And we'll catch you next time here on DC Entrepreneur. Thanks again.
Subscribe to this podcast via iTunes and connect with us on our blog, dcentrepreneur.com. If you have any tips or ideas for stories, please tweet at us or message us on Facebook. Please tune in to our next episode, and thanks for listening.